This is the Music History In-Depth podcast for April 2nd through the 8th. On this week's show, grunge music has its saddest date as a suicide and an overdose claim the lives of two singers. There's two shootings, one of which inspires a great song. And we end on a high note with ABBA becoming overnight sensations. This show goes more in depth about some of the events that we put on our daily podcast, the Music History Today podcast, which drops every single day, including weekends, wherever you get your podcast from. Now, on to this week's episode. On Rolling Stone magazine's list of 500 greatest songs of all time, there's an 80s song that was inspired by a terrible event that happened in April of 1968. That year would be a pivotal one in American history. A president would not seek re-election for a second term due to pressures from the Vietnam War. That year's Democratic Convention in Chicago, Illinois, would pit cops against protesters and convention goers. A presidential candidate would be assassinated. That tumultuous year would start off with this, though. Since the early 1960s, the city of Memphis, Tennessee's garbage workers had been looking to unionize. The city had long been a center of Jim Crow laws, and since the majority of the garbage workers were black, their requests to unionize were, to put it nicely, declined. Sort of like Amazon workers, you might say. For example, in 1963, the city fired 33 workers who had attended a union organizing meeting. On February 1, 1964, in Memphis, Tennessee, two sanitation workers were crushed to death in their garbage trucks. At the time, the city said that they would fix the machine so it wouldn't happen again. Later that year, though, the workers finally got to form a union. As far as fixing defective equipment, the city did virtually nothing. On February 1, 1968, history repeated itself when two more workers were crushed in the garbage truck while they were trying to stay out of the rain. On February 12th, the union held a meeting and decided to go on strike. The workers were striking because of, among other things, the fact that during bad weather, black workers weren't paid for a full day if weather forced them to quit for the day, while white workers were paid a full day's salary regardless of weather conditions. Enter Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. King went to Memphis in March of that year to help support the strikers. He held meetings and marches, the one on March 28th turning deadly when police broke it up, killing one person. On April 3rd, King gave his now famous Been to the Mountaintop speech at the Mason Temple. The ending of the speech, where he talks about death, was mainly in response to the fact that there had been bomb threats made. On the afternoon of April 4th, King stepped out onto a balcony outside of room 306 at the Lorraine Motel. King stayed at the motel a lot, actually. At 6:01 p.m., as he was talking with someone in the parking lot below, a shot rang out, hitting King in the cheekbone. There's some confusion as to whether the shot rendered him unconscious or whether he was alert just long enough to say any final words. King was pronounced dead at St. Joseph's Hospital just over an hour later. Police determined that James Earl Ray, who was an escaped fugitive and had been staying in a rooming house across the street from King's room at the Lorraine Motel, was the man who fired the fatal shot. He was arrested in England, of all places, 2 months later, having escaped there from Tennessee to Atlanta and then to Canada, where he got a fake Canadian passport, flew to England, then to Portugal, and then back to England. Ray passed away from hepatitis C in 1998, proclaiming his innocence, even though he entered a guilty plea at the time. We can discuss conspiracy theories on a different podcast, people. I'm not going to discuss them here. Fast forward 15 years. In November of 1983, the band U2 was working on a song during a sound check during a stop on their war tour, which was in Hawaii at the time. They took the remnants of that song back with them to work on for their next album, The Unforgettable Fire. The lyrical subject of the song was supposed to be about Ronald Reagan and the buildup of the American military machine. Bono changed his mind after reading two books, a biography of Malcolm X and a book by Stephen B. Oates called Let the Trumpet Sound, A Life of Martin Luther King Jr. The band recorded the song at Windmill Lane Studios in Ireland. Chrissie Hynde sang backup vocals on it. Lyrically, Bono hated it. He thought it sounded a little too simple and was just a bunch of lines strung together for no apparent reason other than to talk about Dr. King. Plus, as he realized much later, he screwed up a major line in the song. Early morning, April 4, shot rings out in a Memphis sky. The only way it could have been early morning is if it happened in Hawaii, and even there, it would have been late morning at best. The assassination happened during the dinner hour in Memphis. Bono changed the lines from early morning to early evening, at least sometimes during the concerts, just to get it factually correct. As it was, the song was not at first critically well received. Among the publications that hated it were The Village Voice and, ironically, Rolling Stone. Since then, the song has earned a place on the list of greatest songs ever written by, ironically, Rolling Stone. It's also on the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame's list of 500 songs that shaped rock and roll. U2's classic song, Pride in the Name of Love, about the life and assassination of Dr. Martin Luther King Jr., which occurred on April 4th, 1968. Now, on the In-Depth podcast, we tend to mention grunge music a lot. Part of that could be because I was in my 20s in the 90s and was heavily into grunge, so I know a lot about it. It could also be that it was probably the last great movement as far as rock music goes, at least until people get sick and tired of mumble rap and EDM. I get that people find it whiny, my parents gave me a middle-class upbringing, but I'm ungrateful and spoiled type of music, but you can't deny that it was a major force in music. In grunge music, there were four bands who were chiefly responsible for grunge's rise in power. Two of the lead singers of those bands shared an awful lot in common, including a very tragic date on the calendar. Kurt Cobain was born on February 20, 1967, in Aberdeen, Washington. 6 months later, on August 22, in Kirkland, Washington, Lane Staley was born. Both Kurt and Lane were children of divorce. Kurt's parents divorced when he was nine, which affected him greatly. He started acting out in school, bullying kids, until he himself started to get bullied once he started hanging out with the misfits during high school. Lane's parents, meanwhile, divorced when Lane was seven. He also grew up a Christian Scientist. Once he turned 16, he disavowed the church. Kurt was kicked out of his mother's house when he was 18. He drifted into a couple of relationships, including one with Tracy Miranda, who the song About a Girl is actually about, along with Toby Vail of Bikini Kill, and whose relationship the vast majority of the album Nevermind is about. In fact, once Vail's bandmate, Kathleen Hanna, spray-painted Kurt Smells Like Teen Spirit on Kurt's wall. Teen Spirit was the deodorant of choice that Vail used. Now you know where the song title comes from. Kurt met Chris Novoselic while practicing in a rehearsal space one day. They formed the band Nirvana, the name of which was taken from a Buddhist concept as Kurt was into religion at the time. They went through a few drummers. Chad Channing played drums on their EP Bleach. Kurt didn't like Chad's style of playing, so the band got rid of Chad and brought in Dave Grohl. That move cemented Nirvana's classic lineup. While all this was going on, Lane was busy making music himself. He tooled around in a few small bands that went absolutely nowhere. And then one day in a rehearsal studio, he met guitarist Jerry Cantrell. They were roommates for a time and played in a funk band together, of all things. Jerry was interested in starting a different group with Sean Kinney on drums and Mike Starr on bass. They asked Lane to be the lead singer. Lane said no. Jerry knew, though, that eventually Lane would join. So when Lane was around, Jerry would audition singers who weren't as good, just to get Lane to finally say yes. Apparently, the clincher was when Jerry auditioned a male stripper. They named the band Alice in Chains. A local promoter heard the band play in a local club and got them to do some demos. The promoter took the demos to the managers of local band Soundgarden, who in turn sent them to Columbia Records. Alice in Chains were signed, and on August 21, 1990, their first album, Facelift, was released. It became a big hit in little over a year later, thanks in no small part to Nirvana, who ended up releasing their major label debut, Nevermind, in 1991. Once Nirvana broke through, Alice in Chains followed, along with Soundgarden and Pearl Jam, in pretty rapid succession. And within a few months, these four bands, along with their lead singers, became spokespeople for their generation. Pearl Jam's Eddie Vedder ended up on the cover of Time magazine. Both Pearl Jam and Nirvana ended up on separate covers of Rolling Stone magazine. Being the spokesperson for Generation X never really sat well with Kurt. First, he hated fame. He was quiet. He was also an introvert. He also hated his fans, most of whom he found fake and only in it because it was trendy to like grunge at that point in time. He's not actually wrong on that. There were a lot of people who suddenly loved grunge music who had never even heard of the group Mother Love Bone. That's a whole other issue, though. Lane actually had the same issues, but he didn't hate the fans as much as Kurt did. Soon, both Kurt and Lane turned to one thing, drugs. Kurt was already using by the time Nirvana hit it big, as he was trying different drugs to try to ease the pain of a chronic stomach condition, and I guess a doctor wasn't doing it for him. By the time Nirvana started touring to support Nevermind, he was into heroin. He actually overdosed once before a performance in 1993, but his wife Courtney Love injected him with naloxone to get him conscious again. Kurt also suffered from depression and bipolar disorder, which didn't make things any easier, unfortunately. Finally, the world and the pressures that came with it were just too much for Kurt. On April 5th, 1994, at the age of 27, at a greenhouse at his place on Lake Washington, Kurt penned a suicide note. Sometime thereafter, he took a shotgun to his head and pulled the trigger. His body was found 3 days later by an electrician who had come to do some work on the house. There have been many, many a conspiracy theory that maybe Courtney Love had Kurt killed or someone else did. However, by all accounts from people who saw him towards the end, Kurt was heavily using drugs and was extremely depressed. He had been put into a rehab facility but had left. Meanwhile, Lane was having drug issues of his own. His drug use had gotten so bad that the band was having trouble putting tours together. Still, the band was loyal to Lane and never kicked him out of the band officially. They all just went off and did different projects, that's all. One of the group's last shows was the MTV Unplugged performance. His last official performance with Alice was a concert in Kansas City, Missouri on July 3, 1996. In October of 1996, Lane's former fiance, Demri Lara Perot, passed away from a drug overdose. That, according to many of his friends, was the death knell for Lane. It was almost as if the life had gone out of his body. He started using heavily, and it started, unfortunately, to show. At one point, he weighed around 80 pounds and was losing his teeth. He would show up in public every now and then, sometimes at one of Jerry's concerts, sometimes singing with another side project. He became increasingly isolated from his friends and family. According to bassist Mike Starr, who had left Alice early on and was replaced by Mike Inez, Starr went to Lane's place on April 4th. He could tell that Lane wasn't well and had thought about calling 911. Lane apparently talked him out of it. The two got into a fight, one thing led to another, and Starr stormed out of Lane's house with Lane yelling at him to not leave him like this. All that according to Starr, who himself would end up dying from a drug overdose in 2011. Starr would be the last person to see Lane alive. On April 5th, 2002, exactly 8 years to the day of Kurt Cobain's suicide, Lane took a combination of heroin and cocaine and overdosed, thus completing another similarity between Lane and Kurt. His body was found 2 weeks later by police who were there searching for him once he was reported missing. His body was partially decomposed at the time, and he had to be identified by, well, what was left of his teeth. When you add to all of this the suicide of Soundgarden's lead singer Chris Cornell in 2017, you begin to wonder how Dave Grohl, Jerry Cantrell, and Eddie Vedder managed to survive and still thrive to this day and age. Maybe seeing their friend self-destruct made them not go down that road at the same time. Who knows? What is known is that while we still have the music, sure would have been nice to have had all of them for a while longer. The suicide of Kurt Cobain on April 5th, 1994. The drug overdose of Lane Staley, exactly 8 years later to the day, on April 5th, 2002. Before we go any further, we'd like to tell you about our other podcast. The Music History Today podcast goes over the daily events in music history and drops daily, including weekends, on YouTube and wherever you get your podcasts. There's also the Music Halls of Fame podcast, which talks about a member of the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame, along with other Music Halls of Fame's museums and walks of fame. The Music Halls of Fame podcast drops every Thursday and can also be found on YouTube and wherever you get your podcasts. Now, back to this podcast. I heard it through the grapevine. Sexual healing. How sweet it is to be loved by you. Those are just three of the songs that our next artist made famous. And while it seemed to the public that he lived a charmed life, behind the scenes, it was anything but charmed. The same demons that controlled many other artists controlled him as well, and his death, or rather the way he died, was one of the most shocking moments in music history. Marvin Gaye was born on April 2nd, 1939 in Washington, D.C. His father was a minister while his mother was a domestic worker. He enjoyed singing from a young age when he started singing in his father's church. His father was also extremely strict and would beat Marvin over any childhood transgression. Marvin went into the United States Air Force after high school. He didn't like how strict it was, so he faked mental illness and got a general discharge. He returned to Washington, D.C., where he formed a singing group called the Marquees. While performing around the D.C. area, they came in contact with Bo Diddley, who got them signed to one of Columbia Records' smaller labels. When their first single failed to become a hit, the group was dropped from the label. Right around that time, there was a group called the Moonglows. The co-founder of the Moonglows, Harvey Fuqua, liked the Marquees' sound and signed them to an employee's contract. He also moved the group to Chicago, Illinois, where they worked as session singers while recording their own material, which was when Marvin started writing songs. During a performance at Motown Record president Berry Gordy's house, Berry noticed Marvin's talent and arranged with Fuqua for Marvin to join the Motown family. Marvin's Motown career started off slowly. He was a session drummer while trying to get his records to sell. His debut album, The Soulful Moods of Marvin Gaye, flopped miserably. It wasn't until 1962 that things started clicking for him. Late in 1962, he released his first solo hit, Stubborn Kind of Fella. Things started humming after that. Hit after hit kept coming his way. He started doing duet albums. His first one was with Mary Wells. That was a big hit. He had the hit It Takes Two with Kim Weston. He also had a bunch of hits with Tammy Terrell, including Ain't No Mountain High Enough and Your Precious Love. It was during a performance together in 1967 that Tammy collapsed on stage into Marvin's arms. Tammy, as it turned out, was suffering from a brain tumor. She would have multiple operations and would quit live performing. And she would later pass away from brain cancer in 1970. Her illness and death affected Marvin an awful lot. Marvin recorded What's Going On, but Berry Gordy thought that it was too political. Marvin stopped recording in protest until Motown released the song and the album. Both would go on to be huge hits in the early 70s, and it was at that point that Marvin knew that eventually he would have to gain more creative control over his music. By the time he recorded his final album for Motown Records in 1978, things were not going well for Marvin. First, he was getting divorced. Second, he was dealing with the IRS over back taxes. Third, and possibly most importantly, he was dealing with that old musical demon that we've talked about earlier, drugs. Specifically, this time, cocaine. To escape everything, Marvin went to Europe. When Motown released his last album with them, Marvin realized that they changed the mixing and the editing. He was furious, vowing not to ever do another album with them. In 1982, Motown released Marvin from his recording contract. He then landed at CBS Records, where he recorded his comeback album, Midnight Love, with the smash hit single, Sexual Healing, that still gets played on radio stations everywhere. During the tour for that album, he became more and more dependent on cocaine. He had gotten sober for a time when he was in Europe, and it looked like he would be fine, but that just wasn't to be the case. It got so bad that at one point, he moved back in with his parents, who had relocated to Los Angeles, California. As it turns out, that was a pretty big mistake. Remember that Marvin and his father had a really bad relationship. Marvin even added the E to his last name of Gay, in part to get people to stop making fun of his last name, since it was spelled G-A-Y, but it was also to symbolically get further away from his dad. Marvin decided after all those years that he finally wanted to just make peace with his dad. For Christmas in 1983, Marvin Gaye gave his dad a Smith & Wesson 38 caliber handgun to use as protection. Boy, that was a big mistake. That was mistake number two. The drugs had made Marvin suicidal and paranoid. He had actually attempted to commit suicide on March 28, 1984 by jumping in front of a car. But wouldn't you know it, he only got a few bruises from that. Also during that time, Marvin's parents were arguing a lot, mainly over some missing insurance papers. On April 1st, 1984, Marvin's parents argued about those papers yet again. Marvin tried protecting his mother when his dad came upstairs to confront his mom. Marvin pushed his dad out of the room, told him not to come back in, beat him, and punched him. Marvin followed his dad into his dad's bedroom, still kicking and beating him. Marvin's mother pulled him away and told him to go back into his own room. A few minutes later, Marvin's father came back upstairs and went to Marvin's room. He opened the door, and in his hand was that gun that Marvin had given his father that Christmas before to protect himself. Marvin's dad pointed the gun at his own son and fired twice, once hitting Marvin in his heart and once hitting him in his left shoulder. Marvin passed away less than an hour later, one day before his 45th birthday, by the way. His father would be tried for murder, but once it was determined that he acted in self-defense, he was given a 6-month suspended sentence and 5 years probation. Marvin Gaye's father passed away in 1998 in a nursing home. As with a lot of sudden deaths like this, there's, of course, a conspiracy theory. This one says that Marvin actually wanted to commit suicide but couldn't do it himself, especially after failing only a few days earlier when he tried jumping in front of that car. He purposely enraged his father, knowing that his father would kill him, as his father had stated many a time that if a child of his ever raised their hand to him, he would kill them on the spot. Most parents are actually only half kidding when they say that. Apparently not Marvin's dad. I'm not sure if Marvin did want his dad to kill him, and the fact is, honestly, we're never going to know. We only have witness reports to go by. And what we do know is that the world was shocked. I think most people would have believed a drug overdose or maybe even that suicide might have been a little less shocking, but getting shot by your own dad? Now that was a new one. On MTV's Most Shocking Things to Ever Happen in Music list, Marvin's death actually ranks in at number 8. Number 1, by the way, the death of John Lennon. The life and times of Mr. Marvin Gaye. April 2nd, 1939 to April 1st, 1984. All right, so we've had the death of a civil rights icon, which inspired a great song, the death of a grunge icon by suicide, we had the death of another grunge icon by an overdose, and we had a Motown legend get shot by his own dad. That's an awful lot of death for one podcast. And of course, we can't leave this thing on a depressing note. So let's do a few honorable mentions for the week and then really end it with something good. On April 3rd, 1948, the Louisiana Hayride radio show premiered on KWKH AM in Shreveport, Louisiana. Hayride was a lot like another show, the Grand Ole Opry. However, Hayride played a lot more new artists and broke artists like Hank Williams Sr. and Farron Young. Also, a guy by the name of Elvis played on the show, which gave him another stepping stone on the road to success long before Ed Sullivan got him there. The show also let artists perform with the electric guitar, which was frowned upon at the Grand Ole Opry. Oh, and one other thing. The show's radio host and producer, Horace Logan, tried to quiet down Elvis Presley's fans when he performed on the show. He went to the microphone and said, quote, "Please, young people, Elvis has left the building. Please take your seats," end quote. And now you know where the phrase "Elvis has left the building" came from. The Louisiana Hayride radio show premiered on April 3rd, 1948. This man was born on April 4th, 1913 in Clarksdale, Mississippi. He played the blues when he was younger and traveled up and down the Mississippi Delta until he settled in Chicago, Illinois. And it was there that he developed his style that was copied throughout the region and gave rise to the Chicago blues. His tour of England in 1958 inspired a lot of musicians. In fact, his song Rolling Stone inspired the name of Mick Jagger and Keith Richards' band and also inspired Bob Dylan to write Like a Rolling Stone. The father of the Chicago blues, Mr. Muddy Waters, born April 4th, 1913. On April 8, 1968, Harry Belafonte was performing on Petula Clark's music variety TV show. During a duet together, Petula reached for Harry's arm and wrapped her arm around his. That simple, affectionate act between friends was considered scandalous because it was the furthest that any interracial couple had gone on television at that point. People seriously freaked out over this whole thing. For the record, the kiss between Captain Kirk and Lieutenant Uhura on Star Trek, which was the first interracial kiss on television, didn't actually happen until later in the year, November 22nd to be exact. Oh, and people freaked out over that as well. I sometimes wonder if we've actually come any further since then. We shall see. The scandalous act of a white woman touching a black man's arm on singer Petula Clark's show on April 8, 1968. Benny Andersson was in a popular Swedish group called the Hep Stars in the mid-1960s. Meanwhile, Bjorn Ulvaeus was in another group called the Hootenanny Singers. The groups crossed paths when touring Sweden in the 1960s, and Benny and Bjorn got to know each other pretty well at that point. In June of 1966, Benny and Bjorn decided to write a song together called Isn't It Easy to Say? The Hep Stars' manager, Stig Andersson, who also owned a record label, thought that the song was pretty good, and he told Benny and Bjorn to write together some more. In 1969, Benny and Bjorn submitted a song to the Swedish festival Melodifestivalen, which is the festival that picks the country's representative for the Eurovision Song Contest every year. While they ended up second in voting that year, one good thing actually did come out of all of it. They met Annefrid Langstad, nicknamed Frida, who was also in the competition with her own music. Frida was an up-and-coming singer-songwriter in her own right and had already made a name for herself in Sweden and had performed on national television. Bjorn and Frida started dating, and eventually they got married. The last member of this soon-to-form group was Agneta Falskog, who was also a singer-songwriter and who had a number one song in Sweden. Benny and Agneta met during a festival in 1969, became a couple, and then they got married in 1971. Meanwhile, while they were all on vacation together in 1970, they decided to not only keep writing and producing each other's music, but they also decided to do music together as a group. Now, also right around this time, manager Stig Andersson wanted to break out of Sweden and make a name for himself internationally and decided that he was going to work with the new quartet, then known as Bjorn and Benny, Agneta and Annefrid. After a while, they actually all got sick and tired of ye saying their full names all the time, so they shortened it up to ABBA. To date, none of them have officially said whose name is which letter, so figure that the first A could either be Agneta or Annefrid, depending on the day. ABBA's first hit was the 1972 hit People Need Love, which was released in America on Playboy Records. That actually confused a lot of people who thought that since it was on Playboy Records and was a song called People Need Love and was done by two women and two men, well, then it must be softcore porn. And, well, you could kind of see why some people would think that way. Oh, also in 1972, the group tried to get into the Melodifestivalen yet again by submitting the song Ring Ring. They ended up third this time. But they released the song themselves, and it became a huge hit in Europe. Still, though, they wanted more. In 1973, ABBA decided to submit a song to Melodifestivalen yet again. They were going to submit the song Hasta Mañana. However, that song only showcased one of the two singers, so they decided on a song that was written specifically for that year's contest. They had submitted a song the year before, but it didn't make the finals that year. This new song was recorded on December 17, 1973, and was purposely produced to sound like a Phil Spector Wall of Sound production. This time, they won Melodifestivalen with this song, which was now named Waterloo. The group decided to be different from every other group in the contest. They dressed in flashy silver outfits, complete with big boots. They also had choreography, and the song was upbeat, to things that the contest wasn't really used to at that point. The plan worked. On April 6th, 1974, Waterloo, about a woman surrendering her love to a man, won the Eurovision Song Contest. Another contestant, by the way, who ended up losing to ABBA in the same competition, Olivia Newton-John, who ended up fourth that year. Waterloo was then released worldwide in 1974 and became a big hit. It went number one in a few countries, top 10 in America, and turned ABBA into worldwide overnight sensations. Waterloo has sold over 5 million certified physical copies with claimed sales of over 6 million copies. Also, in 2005, Eurovision put out its list of best songs in the past 50 years of their contest at that time. Waterloo was voted number one. After the success of Waterloo, ABBA were off and running. Songs like Mamma Mia, Fernando, Money, 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 Knowing Me, Knowing You, That's the Name of the Game, Take a Chance on Me, and of course their iconic song Dancing Queen became worldwide hits. They toured relentlessly in the late 1970s, but unfortunately it also put a strain on their marriages and both couples divorced. They still stayed together as a group, though, right up until they unofficially broke up the first time in 1982. Annefried, going under her nickname Frida, had a big solo hit in the 1980s called I Know There's Something Going On, which was produced by Phil Collins. The group would sometimes get together over the decades for special events such as the Swedish premiere for the movie based on their songs, Mamma Mia. Funny thing was that as the decades went on, their music found new audiences, helped by movies such as Mamma Mia, The Adventures of Priscilla, Queen of the Desert, and Muriel's Wedding. There was a touring exhibit called ABBA World in 2010 that caught everyone's attention, along with an ABBA museum in their native Sweden, an appearance in a dancing video game, a box set, and a photo book, proving that the power of ABBA never ever died. In 2020, the group announced that they were putting out a new album, their first one in almost 40 years. The COVID pandemic postponed that for a while, but that also gave the band time to develop a hologram concert called ABBA Voyage. That concert was in London. The end date was May of 2023, but it looks like that concert residency is probably the last thing that the four of them might end up doing together, although there's rumors of another album coming out in the next year or so. Never say never, but as a reminder, they're not spring chickens anymore. They're all in their mid-70s and are entitled to have the fans simply just enjoy the music that they've made and leave it at that. I think they've earned it. ABBA has sold hundreds of millions of records. They're one of the biggest selling groups of all time, as a matter of fact. They've influenced different cultures and definitely different genders. They won countless awards, and even though they've only been nominated for one Grammy Award, their song, Dancing Queen, was inducted into the Grammy Music Hall of Fame. ABBA, winning the Eurovision Song Contest with the song Waterloo on April 6th, 1974. And that is it for the Music History In-Depth podcast for April 2nd through the 8th. Thanks for listening.